if New Yorkers feel that they are experiencing anti-Semitism, if they literally experience anti-Semitism, discrimination, harassment, vandalism, violence, we want to know. I mean, the ADL is a data-driven organization. We've been tracking incidents now for nearly half a century, and we are putting a hyper-local focus on New York because we have a mayor-elect who, through his language and through the policies he's proposing, we are afraid will contribute to an environment that enables anti-Semitism, that creates a permission structure for prejudice.
Welcome to Misgav, Institute for National Security's Mideast Horizons, the podcast for anyone who wants to truly understand what's happening in the Middle East beyond the headlines and spin. I'm Lahav Harkov, your co-host, a Misgav Institute Senior Fellow and Senior Political Correspondent for Jewish Insider. Asher Fredman, the Misgav Institute Executive Director, is not here this week, but I will be here with fresh insights onto critical developments in Israel and updates on trends in the Jewish world, especially this week is about the Jewish world. And I encourage all listeners to subscribe and follow wherever you listen to your podcast to keep up to date and ahead of the curve on everything connected to the Middle East and Israel. You can reach out to us with comments and suggestions at MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com. We read and respond to all of your comments. And in fact, my brief monologue here is going to be in response to a request that I received from a listener. And I want to say thank you to everyone who sent us feedback up until now. On this week's episode, we have Jonathan Greenblatt, the CEO of the Anti-Defamation League. But before that, like I said, I'm going to respond to a request from a listener who asked me to explain the extremely complicated story about the military advocate general that broke in the last week. In order to explain this story, we have to go back to July 2024 when news came out, military police burst into an army base called Sde Teiman in the Negev, where the Nukba terrorists, who were they're like Hamas's special forces, and they were the ones who invaded Israel, or at least the first wave of invasion of Israel on October 7th. And it was a makeshift prison that they had all been put into after October 7th. And there were reservists protecting them, often reservist prison guards. And military police burst into the base and arrested about a dozen of those soldiers on grounds that they had severely abused a Nukba terrorist who was in the Sde Teiman prison. Immediately, protests broke out. First of all, you know, among those soldiers and other soldiers serving on the base, they started to complain to people they knew, whether it was in the media or in the Knesset, that there wasn't severe abuse. And protests took place where just people, members of the public, but also a Knesset member and a deputy cabinet minister, then also burst into that army base and another one to protest the military police's treatment of the soldiers, arguing that these are reservists who left their homes in order to protect the country. And it became a political football. Was there abuse in this prison? Do the soldiers deserve to be arrested? Yes or no? A couple weeks later, a leaked video was aired on Channel 12, which is Israel's most watched news broadcast, like most watched evening news broadcast, that purported to show that the Palestinian terrorist in the prison had been sexually abused by the soldiers. That was what the reporter said. That was how he interpreted the video. In fact, the video showed soldiers standing around with many of them holding riot shields. So you couldn't see what was really happening behind the soldiers, but that was certainly the case that was being built against them, or that was being brought against them by the military prosecution. And at that point, there was a petition to the Supreme Court asking why had this video leaked, right? The videos from within the prison in which arch terrorists are held is extremely sensitive security material. Now, I want to back up a little bit and say, like, as much as Hamas terrorists are despicable people who could rot in hell for all I care, Israel is a country with rule of law, and there's limits to how poorly they could be treated under law, right? So the idea that somebody should sexually abuse a prisoner goes against the law of Israel and is immoral, in my opinion. So this was a very shocking news report to many people. In the world, it was shocking, and in some cases, it raised skepticism within Israel, right? They're like, you know, what kind of normal Israeli IDF reservist, you know, if you're a convicted criminal, you're not an IDF reservist of, you know, convicted of serious crimes. So what kind of person would do this, right? So some people were skeptical by that, because of that. But around the world, this became a news story proving, you know, if not the genocide, then just the cruelty and how terrible Israeli soldiers were. So it became also a really difficult and terrible PR incident for Israel. Fast forward 14 months later. Over that period of time, the Supreme Court ordered the military, ordered for there to be some kind of investigation of who leaked the video, because they agreed that it was, you know, a serious security breach. The deputy military advocate general conducted the investigation. He said, you know, he had nothing to do with the ongoing abuse case. So he was given that task and he assigned it to military police. He got back, he reported to the court and the Knesset over this time that they found that it didn't come from within the unit, right? It didn't come from within the military advocate general's office, and that there's no way to know because there are hundreds of people who might have had access to the video. This is what they told the court and the Knesset. But a week ago, I'm now recording this on Wednesday, so a week ago, the Supreme Court lifted a gag order. Oh, and I should add, the Attorney General, Gali Barab Miara, she also told the court that, you know, she repeated this report that came from within the army. She said there's no way to know who leaked it. So last week, the gag order was lifted, and we found out that the police have been investigating the military advocate general's office. The military advocate general is named Yifat Tomer Yerushalmi, and that they found that she essentially ordered the leak. And soon there were calls for her to be fired. She was immediately suspended, but the defense minister said there's no way she could come back after this. And she wrote a letter, or she sent a resignation letter on Friday, in which she essentially admitted that she knew. And she said that she did it because she wanted to, like, show that what they had done had been justified, that they arrested these reservist prison guards. On Sunday, she disappeared. She left a note to her family, which we don't know the exact content of the note. The one line that's been quoted in all Israeli media is that she wrote, "Don't look back." And clearly, they thought it was some kind of suicide note. She also didn't show up to a meeting with her lawyer. So her lawyer and her family called police to say that she was missing. Her car was found abandoned near a beach in North Tel Aviv. Eventually, after a few hours, she was found walking around north of Tel Aviv on the beach. She was found without her phone. Police arrested her. They put her on suicide watch to make sure she doesn't hurt herself. But they also suspected that the entire suicide note and disappearance she was faking in order to have an excuse to destroy her phone and destroy that evidence. So that is an allegation against her right now. She is in jail. Her remand was extended by the court. And we'll wait and see what happens with that. But in the meantime, there's an uproar and there's calls to investigate. But the current government does not want the Attorney General to investigate this because they say, well, she has a conflict of interest, that she defended the military advocate general's unit and took their word as gospel. And so she cannot do the investigation. And there's other questions about how she conducted things, you know, in the days after the gag order was lifted. Like, once it became public that this woman is suspected of the leak, but also possible perjury related to the leak, and she could go to prison for it, why was she not put on some kind of house arrest or being watched? She also had not been interrogated once at that point at all. And not just her, also the chief military prosecutor, who apparently knew. There's been 8 people arrested in relation to this whole thing since then. So Justice Minister Yariv Levin is appointing a retired judge to lead the investigation. And he says the Attorney General can't have anything to do with it. But the Attorney General herself she says she isn't conducting the investigation. Now, remember that this government tried to fire the attorney general also. So that's where things stand now. I hope listeners are slightly less confused about this. I know this is like a very domestic political thing and not the topics we usually talk about, but I know it's also the talk of Israel this week and a very complicated and confusing story. So I hope people understand it a little more. Now we're going to go to our guest. Jonathan Greenblatt is the CEO of the Anti-Defamation League, the leading anti-hate organization, and the author of It Could Happen Here, a book sounding the alarm on hate and systemic violence in the U.S. He was previously special assistant to President Obama and an entrepreneur before that. And we're really excited to have Jonathan Greenblatt here. We wish he were here to discuss better news, but that's what happens when you're the leader of an organization fighting anti-Semitism. And we're going to talk about Zohran Mamdani's election as mayor of New York, someone who many, many Jews have concerns about his views about Israel and whether he would be a partner in fighting anti-Semitism. So thank you, Jonathan Greenblatt, for coming onto the podcast. Last time I interviewed you, it was a different world. I was on a different podcast, too.
Right.
Today, we're talking the day after Zohran Mamdani was elected mayor of New York. Can't say it was a surprise because it's basically what the polls showed would happen. But I know many, many Jews in New York are disappointed. And I understand that the Anti-Defamation League is going to be tracking things that he says and does that might be problematic for New York Jews. So can you tell us a little bit about what that effort's going to look like?
So look, we're really just in the wake of this historic election, had extraordinary turnout. A lot of young people came, and that's remarkable, and it's healthy, and I encourage you to see them take part in the democratic process. It is also true that the mayor that was elected, Zohran Mamdani, is incredibly problematic, not based on like how I feel, but based on what he has done. What do I mean by that? He's an SJP organizer. He was a rapper who celebrated, you know, convicted terrorists. He, as a state assemblyman, sponsored bills that, again, were deleterious to the Jewish community. And flash forward over the last, I don't know, 6 months of the campaign, globalized the intifada and his unwillingness to call it out was literally just the beginning. So one of the things I think, as you know, and as your listeners know, as Jews, we know that when people tell us something, we should listen to them and take them at their word. So it is true that he said last night in his opening speech, or his acceptance speech, that he wants to, or he basically said that no anti-Semitism, he wants to fight the scourge of anti-Semitism. And it's also true that this morning, trying to make up for the lack of inclusivity in his speech, he doubled down on that and said, I want, you know, anti-Semitism is bad. And yet, he has a track record, a real track record, that is deeply, deeply problematic. It's why my phone has rung off the hook over these last few weeks, last 24 hours. It's why my texts keep blowing up. It's because New Yorkers are alarmed that someone who's sort of who breezily describes himself as an anti-Zionist, who mischaracterizes the BDS movement as nonviolent, who openly makes comments like he's going to divest Israel from Israel bonds or will re-examine the relationship between the Cornell University's Institute here in Manhattan that is tied to the Technion. By the way, not because of the quality of the research or because of the graduation rates or because of the efficacy of the programs, simply because its academic partner is Israeli. And so against the backdrop of skyrocketing anti-Semitism, we have taken concrete steps so Jewish New Yorkers know we will keep them safe.
One of the things that he said was he said that when the boot of the NYPD is on your neck, it is laced up by Israel.
Yeah, I mean, he said the IDF, which is even more disgusting and pernicious.
And it reminded me back in like the 2020 with the sort of George Floyd aftermath and when everyone was talking about racism and the ADL was involved in trainings that had been invited to be involved in some trainings, like anti-racist trainings, and people didn't want the ADL to be included because the ADL helped facilitate a cooperation between the NYPD and Israeli police. So I thought maybe you would have insight into sort of this particular conspiracy theory about Israel?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. It's sort of part conspiracy theory and part like fever dream.
Yeah.
Mostly it's just libel. So number one, the idea that the ADL or any American organization is bringing NYPD or any law enforcement or Ferguson police or any law enforcement agency to train with the IDF is a lie. It is a fiction. It is a complete contrivance. And I would argue, I don't know if any law enforcement agency in the United States has ever trained with any military across around the world. Like, I don't know, so I won't pretend to be an expert. You better believe none of them train with the IDL. Now, ADL has brought law enforcement to learn from, to work with the Israel National Police, and I'm proud of that. And the NYPD has an intelligence unit in Israel that, you know, shares information, and I'm proud of that. It saved lives. So, yeah, that video of Mayor-elect Mamdani saying that 2-some-odd years ago, in August 2023, is just an example of why New Yorkers are alarmed. So we're taking concrete steps to shut this down. Number one, today we launched a tip line. So if New Yorkers feel that they are experiencing anti-Semitism, if they literally experience anti-Semitism, discrimination, harassment, vandalism, violence, we want to know. I mean, the ADL is a data-driven organization. We've been tracking incidents now for nearly half a century. And we are putting a hyper-local focus on New York because we have a mayor-elect who, through his language and through the policies he's proposing, we are afraid will contribute to an environment that enables anti-Semitism, that creates a permission structure for prejudice. So number one, a tip line. Number two, we're going to double down on our research to track what he does and what happens around him. And then number three, we've launched the Mamdani Monitor. And this will be an online presence that simply reports on what's happening at and around City Hall related to our community. So let me be clear. I come at this not as a pessimist, not as a cynic. It's not about gotcha. Maybe we'll see good things. Maybe we'll make us hopeful and optimistic. The bottom line is, though, we are going to pay very, very close attention to who he promotes into roles, what kind of policies he seeks to implement, and what kind of programs he tries to introduce. Because I think, again, personnel, policies, programs, these are the building blocks, not just of a mayoral administration. These are the building blocks of the way government shapes society. And when I think about the role that he will play in the lives of over a million Jewish New Yorkers, because of his control over education, his control over law enforcement, his control over the pension fund, the municipal service, and so on, like, he's going to have hit both of his hands on the wheel. And so what our job is at ADL, again, without any preconceived notions, without any foregone conclusions, is to make sure that we shine a very bright light and hold him accountable wherever the day may take us.
So that actually brings me to a question that a lot of people have asked me, right? Where people will say, you know, who cares if the mayor of New York recognizes Israel's right to exist? Like, he doesn't affect foreign policy. And like, okay, so Netanyahu won't be able to visit the UN once a year. What's the big deal? What do you think the practical implications are for Jewish people in New York, for Israelis living in New York with Mamdani as mayor?
Look, again, anti-Semitic incidences, if I haven't said it already, have reached historic levels across America. And this is the city, not just with the most Jewish people in America, but with the most Jewish people in the world.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I have heard stories of Israelis, I can't recall, Israeli Americans or Israeli expats, but afraid to speak Hebrew on the subway. I've heard stories about Jewish people visibly identified as Jews because they're wearing a chai necklace or a Magen David or a kippah or a shaydal, being harassed, being yelled at, being like physically assaulted. I've heard stories about restaurants that are Israeli or kosher, or Judaica stores, and certainly synagogues being vandalized. We have examples of people's personal spaces, private homes, also being defaced. Again, not because of their policy vis-a-vis, you know, the current government in Israel, but simply because they are Jews.
And today we had at the Magen David School in Brooklyn, which is a school from the Syrian Jewish community, defaced the swastikas.
That's right.
Yeah.
So again and again and again, we are reminded in this moment that Jews have a high degree of vulnerability. And so the question becomes, when the mayor says he wants to be the mayor for all Jewish people, don't, you know, don't tell me, show me, which means make sure that, you know, are you going to follow through on these policies that, again, create an environment which Jewish people, anyone who identifies as Zionist, feel threatened? Or are you going to ensure that law enforcement, you know, has the ability to keep our Jewish community safe? Are you going to reset the education system? So instead of the Holocaust education that our kids get in K through 12 in New York public schools, you introduce ethnic studies, some of the things we've seen in other localities and states, which is really just a way to undermine, you know, educating young people about Judaism and the Jewish experience. So we'll be tracking all those things, paying very close attention, because it has consequences.
Yeah.
Now, look, I want to just say again, maybe we'll be impressed. Maybe he will do the right thing. And maybe we will be depressed that he will do the wrong thing. We come at this with an open mind. We come at this without, again, having a partisan persuasion. The only thing I care about is protecting the Jewish people. That's it.
So I'll ask another question coming from the left, which is, you hear this argument also, well, if 30% of Jews in New York voted for him, how could he be bad for the Jews? What do you say to people who say that?
I don't know what to say about that. Like, yeah. It's clear that a lot of people voted for him. That's how he won. It's clear that a lot of young people voted for him. And it seems probable that a number of Jewish young people voted for him. But let me make sure your audience hears this. The reports and the rumors that all the young people were Nami, it's not true. Because I can tell you about the scores of Jewish young people who I've spoken to in the last few months here in New York City, who most definitely didn't vote for him. So we have to avoid sort of selection bias, where we hear what we want to hear, and instead look at the real raw numbers. Now, all that being said, you know what? The main issue in the city right now, Lahav, is affordability. Like, New York is an expensive place to live. From the inflationary impact of the inflationary impact on people's lives is real, from grocery prices to the subway fares to just day-to-day living. So yeah, people are concerned. And I think that is what drove the majority of the voters. But I must say, I've got to say, we ignore the impact in our community at our own peril. Again, you can be concerned about affordability, but to do it at the expense of Jewish New Yorkers, I don't think that's okay at all. And so even if some of those Jewish New Yorkers voted for him, just because you're Jewish doesn't mean consciously or unconsciously you can't traffic in anti-Semitism. Just because you are Black or Asian or Latino doesn't mean you can't traffic in racism, consciously or unconsciously. Just because you're a woman doesn't mean you can't be sexist. Just because you are LGBTQ doesn't mean you can't say it's homophobic. I mean, so someone's ethnicity or faith doesn't exempt them from intolerance. And I know this to be true because, yeah, there are these, you know, anti-Zionist young people in like Park Slope, but look at the lived experience of their Jewish kind of brothers and sisters just down the road, you know, at 770 and in that area.
Or in Brighton Beach.
All of it. Like visibly identifiable Jewish people, particularly Orthodox people, are disproportionately subjected to harassment and to other violative behaviors. It's not okay. And if you don't understand the connection between you screaming Free Palestine and then, you know, people with malevolent agendas going into those neighborhoods and assaulting people and saying this is for Gaza, whether it's, again, assaulting a woman wearing a shidel, or it's burning down the governor's home in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, or it's shooting two young people walking out of a Jewish museum in D.C., or it's firebombing a march for the hostages in Boulder, Colorado, like, these things are linked. And so again, you can be for the Jewish, you can be for fighting anti-Semitism, but you need to have the sophistication to recognize if you say that in one breath and then it's espouse globalized intifada in the other breath, that's hypocrisy. And that doesn't serve anyone.
on a very different topic, a few weeks ago, FBI Director Kash Patel had some choice words about the ADL. I believe it was in reaction to an extremist group tracker in which they called Turning Point USA an extremist group. And this was something that had been sort of resurfaced online after the killing of Charlie Kirk.
Yeah.
And it was interesting to me how much, you know, the assassination of Charlie Kirk actually really resonated with a lot of Israelis. A lot of his content about Israel had been translated into Hebrew. Why did the ADL call Turning Point an extremist group? And sort of what, if anything, has changed in that assessment?
A bunch of things. First of all, Kash Patel posted some, I think, fairly unfair comments about ADL.
Yeah.
But he based it on the fact that Jim Comey gave a speech at ADL in 2014. Mm. So he didn't talk about Charlie Kirk in his tweet. He talked about Turning Point USA in his tweet. He talked about James Comey, who, again, gave a speech at ADL more than 11 years ago. Okay, so on that basis, I understand that he, you know, has certain feelings about the organization. We deeply value our partnership with law enforcement. We've been working with them literally since the FBI was founded in the 1930s, longer than any other Jewish group or, I think, NGO in America. We work with law enforcement at the federal, state, local level every day. We hope to continue to do that to keep our community safe. Not about how people vote. I don't care how you vote. What I care about is how do we address the vulnerabilities that affect, you know, our brothers and sisters here in the places where they worship or the offices where they work or the places where they shop. That's what I care about. And I hope we continue to work with law enforcement in that regard. With respect to Turning Point USA, we never call them a hate group. We never said that. We don't have hate groups. We're not the SPLC. We did have an entry in our Glossary of Extremism that delineated examples where their membership or leaders had said things that were, you know, very homophobic, racist, espoused Christian nationalism. And that content was all substantiated with citations, things they really said. But I think what's salient in your question and important for your audience to know is we made a mistake in that in our entry on Turning Point USA, I don't regret that we mentioned those issues, which are real issues. I do regret that we didn't highlight the fact that he was an avowed champion against anti-Semitism. He spoke out publicly, forcefully, sincerely about why Jew hatred was, I think he called it some kind of like mind-eating virus. It was a miss that we didn't include that information entry on Turning Point USA. We should have. Now, all that being said, there is this ferocious debate now taking place on the right. You're seeing it play out where the Heritage Foundation and its leader, Kevin Roberts, sort of like laundering, legitimizing Tucker Carlson in his recent interview with Nick Fuentes. It's repellent. It's disgusting. You know, I think that Tucker Carlson's been a problem for years. We've been saying this. Now that he's no longer on Fox and he's sort of, you know, unleashed, you can see in all his glory, he platforms Holocaust deniers, neo-Nazis, I mean, just like all kinds of rank bigots. So yeah, we have a problem with that. We do. But you know, what's funny is I come back to the Turning Point entry. As we see evidence by Carlson, like we are living in a moment today where anti-Semitism has reached heights we've never seen, where again, you have mayors getting elected to government, as happened here yesterday, who espouse anti-Zionism. You have popular podcasters like Carlson who espouse anti-Semitism. And so we've had to make a decision here at ADL that we are going to really cease and desist from anything other than anti-Semitism at this moment. When this organization was founded in 1913, it has always had what you would call an intersectional mission to fight anti-Semitism and all forms of hate. But right now, we cannot keep up with the anti-Semitism on its own. So whereas in the past, we've ranged beyond that core purpose of protecting the Jewish people, right now, it's all we're doing. And, you know, I'm going to be honest, it's not easy, but we are focused, and we don't always get it right. Like I told you about Turning Point, but we are focused and doing everything humanly possible so that our community knows that ADL has their backs and so that our enemies know that ADL will come after them.
On that note, it's like an interesting trajectory in a way for the ADL, because I think during the first Trump administration, there was a lot of criticism from more conservative Americans that the ADL had become part of the quote-unquote resistance to President Trump, almost, that it wasn't being bipartisan as or nonpartisan, I would say, as its mission should have been. Now I see in the second Trump administration criticism coming from liberals on the left that ADL is being obsequious to the Trump administration. Which, I mean, like you said, the ADL cooperates with law enforcement. Like, it's sort of like you have to be able to work with these people. But what do you respond to these kinds of criticisms?
Look, it's crazy. Like, I don't. Like, I keep my head down and do the work. I mean, I think our job at ADL is it doesn't matter if the person at bat is wearing a red uniform or a blue uniform. Our job is to call balls and strikes and to maintain the same strike zone. So it doesn't matter, again, who's at bat. So that's germane, and I hope your audience understands the sports metaphor. But, like, we're not partisan. And so, look, we criticize candidate Trump for some of the things he said and did, and then we've worked with President Trump where we can, and we've praised him where we thought it was appropriate. And we've criticized candidate Mamdani for some of the things that he has said and done. And I trust we'll be able to work with him where appropriate. And if he gets it right, we will credit him for doing so. That's our job at ADL. Again, not to pick winners, not to play favorites. If you read or listen to right-wing media, you will hear that ADL is a woke operation and I'm an Obama operative. If you listen to and watch and read progressive media, you will hear that ADL is a MAGA operation and I am a Trump apologist. It is bizarre to think that I can both be, in the same breath, a Trump apologist, really, right? And, you know, someone for the other side. That I can be a Zionist cudgel and a self-hating Jew. I mean, I hear it all the time. It's crazy. So I don't listen to it. I say I hear it all the time. I hear it all the time, but I don't pay attention to it, is what I meant to say. Now, all that being said, the job here is to protect the Jewish people. And that is what I'm focused on. That's what we're all focused on every single day and will be for the foreseeable future.
So I know we don't have a lot of time, but I want to ask you, I mean, so much anti-Semitism is spread unchecked on social media. And there was a time when social media companies, let's say, more aggressively policed these kinds of things. And I believe that they even sought the ADL's advice on these things sometimes, depending on the company. And then it kind of fell out of fashion, let's put it that way. What efforts do you think the ADL and other organizations can make to try to combat the real, just like, cesspool of anti-Semitism online?
Well, let's be honest. I mean, it's sort of embedded in the question. Like, there's no silver bullet.
Yeah.
So social media has sort of seized, you know, if you will, like, the public conversation, and it's now mediated through algorithms, invisible to us, but, like, manifest on our phones. So you and I could be sitting literally, like, on the same sofa in the same house, looking at our phones, getting two entirely different worldviews. You know, Steven Pinker's got this good new book about common knowledge. I think it's a problem when common knowledge has exploded and when there's no shared understanding of what, like, ground truth is. For a lot of our young people, ground truth is, you know, ChatGPT, which itself is drawing information to its large language model from, like, Wikipedia and Al Jazeera. Like, that is really troubling. If we are going to solve this problem, we need to get upstream and we've got to figure out how to get these companies to do the right thing. Again, like you said, it's kind of out of fashion these days for them to be policing. But look, I don't think it's cancel culture, not the platform Nazis. I don't think it's cancel culture, not the platform jihadists. So we would hope that they will do better in the future. And we've got a whole robust sort of advocacy agenda, like pushing and pushing and pushing. I mean, you just got to keep at it. It ain't going to happen overnight. It's not easy, but we can't lose sight of our, you know, of these goals.
Are you optimistic about TikTok now that sort of an American conglomerate has bought part of the American operation?
Yeah. I mean, look, TikTok, in my mind, I was not someone who believed that changing the ownership will necessarily affect the performance of the product. Case in point, Facebook, founded and owned by a Jewish man, Mark Zuckerberg, and really helped built by Sheryl Sandberg, two Jewish people. Instagram, I think one or both the founders Jewish. Twitter, one of the founders Jewish. Like I could go on, but the point is that all those guys are Americans, and X and Insta are so damaging, I think, to the public conversation. So I don't think that the nationality of the ownership will necessarily make it better. The only way it gets better is if the ownership is committed to that outcome. And on that point, I'm optimistic. What else can you be?
Thank you so much.
Hope this is helpful. I appreciate you so much. I really, really want you to know how much I respect and learn from your journalism and your writing. So thank you for that.
Thank you so much.
To so many of us. So I would be remiss if I didn't express my gratitude to you.
So that's very kind of you. And thank you again. Thank you for listening. Make sure to subscribe, like, and follow Misgav at misgavins.org and on social media. Send your comments, questions, and suggestions to MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com. And we'll see you next week.